Hey guys, it's your favorite sisters with the Confessions of a Reluctant Caregiver show on UK Health Radio. On the show, you'll hear caregivers confessing the good, the bad, and the completely unexpected. You're guaranteed to relate, be inspired, leave with helpful tips and resources, and of course, laugh. Now, let's get to today's confession. Hey, Jay.
Hey, Natalie.
You know, it's already been quite the morning this morning, but you know what's the best thing to do on a Wednesday?
Eat.
Oh, I do like to eat. No, I'm thinking about, well, we're not going to talk about eating. This is
a
podcast on eating. You're very distracting.
I'm sorry.
No,
I'm sorry.
We should have another guest confessor, and we have the best one today.
You know, what I like about him is he showed up this morning with a sticky on his head that said, "I confess." That is
how good
this confession is going to be
I
today.
I love him. Yes. I love him. He's my bestie.
Oh, you have so many besties. I mean,
I do, but I don't discriminate, but I love to have the more besties you can have, the better. So you should tell everyone about Todd.
Okay. That's fantastic.
Hey,
thanks. It's my turn to talk, y'all. So today we have Todd Keats with us. And here's what he says. He says he has been a lifetime social good evangelist.
Yes,
he is.
That's like
an introduction.
He's a social evangelist. That's like being a mental health concierge. That's what I call myself. He's a social evangelist.
This is my turn to talk. You're going to have to shut it down.
Sorry.
That is a heading that I love. Like, I would put that at the top of everything. So he has lots of accolades and achievements, but this is what I'm going to tell you. I get to choose my favorite. And my favorite is that he volunteered as a hugger for Special Olympics. And since I'm a hugger, that is my favorite, Todd. So I'm going to throw that out there. But in 2018, he noticed during weekly video chats that his mom was looking worse each time, and he organized some doctor's appointments, and he flew to Florida from his home in California to accompany her to the visits. Now, what happens in the next few years with both his mom and his dad, I'm leaving to Todd to share, because it is quite a ride. I think there's some miracles involved in there as well. Totally changed Todd's life. Like, I think it changed your trajectory, Todd. So it is a journey. We are so glad to have you here with us today. Let's get started. Natalie, the answer is not you were born and then you went to caregiving.
Fine. Todd, you can start somewhere, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, thank you for the introduction, first off. And yeah, that journey, I mean, my gosh, it certainly changed my life completely. And most of all, I'm sitting here with you. If that didn't happen, we would not be sitting here today. So
exactly.
It's the culmination of everything is right at this moment.
So give us a little deets on your background with your, like, grew up, you've got siblings, your parents. Give me a little bit of deets on that.
Okay. Yeah. I grew up, born in Philadelphia.
Okay.
Raised outside in the suburbs, brother, sister's 3.5 years younger. Sister, brother is 7 years younger.
And so you're the oldest.
Yes.
That's me.
Yes.
That's birth order is very important.
We are very big into birth order.
Yes.
Okay, keep going.
I'm oldest. Yeah. I mean, gosh, it was a childhood. Yeah, it was fun. I mean, we had a lot of fun growing up in our house. You know, like every family, you have your challenges as well. And we had those too. Yeah. Working the caregiving aspect early on at 9 years old, I was helping with my uncle. Mm-hmm. He was living with us for a year. He had has Crohn's disease and way back had a colostomy. I mean, that's back before it was reversible or anything. So I was one helping out with that. And then, went on to college, played baseball. That was my big thing. And ended up doing the corporate thing until I had to talk like Kermit the Frog in a presentation to 1,000 people.
That's a different story. Oh, you did Kermit the Frog voice for 1,000 people? Okay, I'm going to tell you, after this episode, we're going to have some extra content. I definitely want you to tell the story again. So you'll learn about Kermit the Frog at the end.
Yeah.
Okay, keep going.
Yeah, so then I had been doing a lot of work consulting in the 90s with the pharmaceutical industry and medical device industry. And Married, divorced in the 90s and had nothing really holding me there other than my family in Philadelphia area. But I loved California. So I decided, hey, I'm moving out there. And it was great, hiking every day. And just, it was beautiful, of course. And the weather was a heck of a lot better in the winter than in Philadelphia.
Preach.
Yeah. And yeah, it was awesome. And then in 2012, my dad calls me and says, I have an idea. Now, keep in mind, my dad would call me every week, every day. Hey, I have an idea.
But this he sounds like somebody right up my alley. I'm like, oh, Jay, I have an idea. And then we started a podcast.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So he said, hey, I have this idea and you want to be a part, you know, part of it. It'd be you, me and Michael, my brother. And it was to start a company called, well, we didn't know what it would be called at that point in time. It ended up being called Stock for Good, which was automate the stock donation process to nonprofit organizations.
Wow.
And I said, yes, sure. So I moved back to Philadelphia in 2012 from California. And we started that. I was CEO and I started building out a team and raising capital and building out the software, patenting the software. And it was awesome. And then you're earlier offline when you were telling me about what happened with work today for you, I had a gut punch as well, so to speak. And on the eve of our launch in 2017, it was the week before Thanksgiving, our key partner pulled out. And that was professionally the most challenging moment of my life. And I was just, we were blindsided. And I had to sit back and basically think about, well, what are we going to do? So I talked to advisors. I talked to the board. I talked to everybody, the team, of course. And I said, just give me a month. This is the culmination at that point of 5 years of hard work, ups and downs. And I just said, give me a month. I just need to kind of step away. And I did. And I came back with a strategy and moved back out to California and started meeting using my connections.
Yeah.
With Facebook, Cisco, Google, all these companies, they loved the idea. They didn't want to invest, but they made some great introductions. So I was moving forward with those introductions and having great meetings. And then my mom started getting sick. And so I came for that visit that you mentioned earlier. And I just decided, well, it wasn't even a decision. It was like within the 3 weeks I was here, my mom's hemoglobin went from 12 to 5. And so she's barely alive. We get her up. I take her to a local hospital. They give her a transfusion. They come in and they say, well, you know, she's got a lot of other things going on. Well, yeah, we know. And everything moves slow. And I said, this is a part of my advocacy. So I'm glad we're talking about this. And we're going to talk about a lot. But I said to I went to the nurse manager. I said, I'm taking my mom out of here. And she said, you can't do that. And I said, I can do that. And she said, no, you can't. I said, yes, I can. And I'm going to. And she said, well, I can't give you permission to do that. You need to talk to an administrator. I said, first off, patient rights, I don't need that permission. I can sign out and sign her out. And so that's what I did. And got an ambulance, had her taken to Cleveland Clinic here in Weston, Florida, which is an amazing facility. And yeah, they saved her life at that moment. And that was the first of 17 hospitalizations in 22 months.
So at that point, Todd, did you say, hey, guess what? I'm going to leave California. I need to be here all the time or?
Work, because that seems like there's a time difference too.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a time difference. Yes. you're funny. there was never a time to think. There just wasn't a time because it was that hospitalization, which lasted 3 weeks, went right into rehab, which lasted another 10 days to 2 weeks, and then got home. And then within 2 weeks, she was back in the hospital.
Yeah.
So there was, you know, there was never a time to really think, all right, what am I going to do at that point? Yeah. That didn't happen for years. Yeah.
So your parents had moved from Philly to Florida. They were they migrated down south.
They did.
And so at that point, because I mean, what was, well, one, did you have medical power of attorney and all the things like that? Because people could be looking and saying, oh, did you really just sign her out?
at that point, no. they did not anticipate. They had a health surrogate document, and they had all of that in place, but nothing in anticipation of this. So it was a matter of, I just kind of took over. And I love my dad dearly, but my dad's healthcare acumen just, you know, wasn't going to be even close to what I could bring to the table. And, and I'm just a, we'll say, take charge person when it comes to this.
Really?
The oldest? Is that what we're saying, Todd?
Did not get a sense of that.
Yeah. Yeah. So are your siblings, are they still in Philadelphia? Is that because they're not in Florida? They've not moved to retirement yet, I guess.
No, they are. My brother is in the Philadelphia area / New York City now with his significant other, once his kids left the coop, so to speak. And my sister is in Scottsdale, Arizona.
So you're just like, okay, well, he's the one that gets to go.
Did your siblings kind of do this? Because that's what we do to JJ sometimes. Emily and I will put our finger on our nose for those of you who can't see. We'll just put our finger. We're like, Jay, what do you want us to do?
hey, nominate me.
No, you know, I had a lot of background, as I mentioned, in healthcare, and I had a lot of confidence in that. And I was always the organizer, and just as a leader, it was just something I was comfortable with, and I knew how to read charts and so forth. And it was just one of those that, hey, let's get this done. I mean, there's nobody who was going to be able to do that. I mean, if you go back to, and again, I love my dad, but in that moment where we're sitting at the regional hospital, we're going in for her transfusion. This is before the hospitalization. Yeah. And my dad and my mom are sitting there because, you know, my dad is the surrogate at that point in time. And so they're sitting somewhere and I'm talking to a doctor at Cleveland Clinic about getting her in there because fortunately we had a contact. My mom's cousin worked for the NIH for many years. And so he had a contact at Cleveland Clinic. It wasn't necessary, but it certainly helped when we when we eventually arrived there. But my dad and mom are sitting at the local community hospital, and the woman's saying, "Well, this is just a type and screen. You'll be back on Thursday for the for the transfusion." And my dad's about to sign. I said, "Don't sign that." And I said to the woman, "I said, with all due respect, she's not going to make it till Thursday. Her hemoglobin's gone from 12 to 5 in 3 weeks. What do we do? How do we get this done today?" And she said, "Oh, well, you'll have to go through the emergency room." I said, "That's what we're doing, Dad. Let's go." And I took my mom and I wheeled her down to the emergency room. And so, I could talk about many instances like that in terms of advocacy.
That's crazy. That's crazy to think that. And was that the physician who shared that with you to say, "Oh," or was that just the scheduler and they're just following what the order sheet says?
Yeah, there was a number of people. You mean in the local hospital?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a few people. It started with the nurse. It started with then the nurse manager. And then eventually the administrator came in. But by that point, I was already making plans and getting her out of there.
And your dad was just following along.
Yeah. My dad really, he's an accountant by trade. He didn't have the background in healthcare to know what patients' bill of rights meant and so forth and so on. And, and my dad's great. He's like, "Todd, go for it. You do what you got to do." I mean, he's been like that. I mean, he's an amazing guy to say, "Hey, Todd," he trusted me implicitly with his wife. I mean, my mom. So pretty incredible.
Jay, we need to take a break just for a quick sec, and then we'll be right back because this is good stuff. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
All right, Nat, we are back. We're talking with Todd. And Todd something. We do love Todd, but he just said something that really made me think. And that is, the doctor in the facility isn't always right. And you absolutely have the right to say, nope, we are changing our mind. That is not correct. And we are moving on. Todd, I love that we can just stand up for ourselves. So you are your best advocate or the advocate for your family member. So, so you guys go to the Cleveland Clinic. Your mom is, she is in the hospital in and out 17 times. Is that right? Over 22 months?
Yes.
But she, there's at some point, you know, I want to know, first of all, did you leave your job in Cal? Well, you said California, but did you eventually, your career path changed during that time? Did you leave that job?
Yeah. I mean, I put it to the side. I mean, I was responsible for that company, for that business. Yeah. And since we had, had that gut punch where the partner pulled out, everybody sort of then just was tacitly furloughed in a way, because we didn't know what we were doing. And then when my mom got sick the first time, they were great. Everybody was incredibly patient, from the advisors to the investors to the team. And they kept waiting. And then eventually, you know, they realized, hey, they got to do what they got to do, and they got to find where they're, what path they're going on.
That speaks a lot, I think, about priorities, that I have to, I'm in this and I got to step up, and this becomes a real priority for me. So
yeah. And, you know, I honestly, I never really even thought about, okay, this is a priority. It wasn't a thought process. Like,
yeah,
this is just what it is. Mm-hmm. And I'm there.
Yeah.
So you, did you end up keeping your home in California for a while and then eventually selling it, or did you have this realization? Did it take you a minute to come to the fact that I'm probably going to be a Floridian?
Yeah, well, the beautiful part of this was I didn't own a home out there. So I did not have to worry about that. And as far as the part about becoming a Floridian, I didn't even think about that for years, because I was so in the, I was thinking about it this morning, before we got on. I'm like, we're going to talk about this. And because I'm talking with you two, who I love, I'm just thinking, this is going to be a different kind of conversation than I've had in podcasts. And not that I don't enjoy everyone that I do, but I, you know, I just didn't really think about it for years, because I was just so in the midst of 24/7 caregiving advocacy. And it was something every time you turned around. And I was trying to think, you know, I know we talk about, what are some funny things that happen? I'm thinking, gosh, funny in the midst of that. I'm trying to think of what are funny things. And there were funny things. There was everything of the whole gamut. But yeah, I didn't think about becoming a Floridian for years.
Mm. So your mom, but she improved over time. So yeah, that 22-month journey, you survived, she survived. You guys made it through that. And what was next? Because it did not,
it's after, because the assumption was that your mom was going to pass, that she had a terminal illness that was not so terminal.
Yeah. So interesting, her disease, which is systemic scleroderma, I don't know if they ever say terminal with that.
Okay.
It's something like a lot of diseases, which ultimately will take your life in one way, shape, or form.
Right.
It's not like a cancer diagnosis where it's spread and it's terminal and you know, you have 3 months, 5 months, 6 months, whatever it is. So during those 22 months, there was never a sign of her getting better. It was always unbelievably managing. I mean, I have stories that I could spend hours talking about, just the craziness of advocacy, or at least my level of advocacy, which, driving down the Cleveland Clinic when a doctor wouldn't get on the phone, I drove down 45 miles to go knock on the door, and they said, well, you can't talk to them. I'm like, I'm going to stand here.
I respect that.
Exactly right.
And because this is not okay. And so there are many other stories, that just one. So then the 17th hospitalization happened to be, this is getting back to answer your question, JJ, the 17th hospitalization, which happened to have been 2 weeks after the COVID lockdown. This is powerful. I have a hard time talking about this, but my mom can't breathe. She's, you know, just, she can't breathe. She can't move. And I'm like, oh my God, this is COVID. We don't know. So I'm in there with a mask. My dad's in there with a mask. We didn't know at that point, we were probably already infected. If she did, she didn't, but called 911. She was taken to a different local hospital this time than that first one. And we get a call. We weren't allowed in. I mean, everything, you know, it was locked down. You couldn't go in. You couldn't. And so we get a call from the doctor about an hour or two later saying, your mom's unresponsive. Does she have a DNR? And like, holy moly. So I said, she does. And the doctor, who was very kind, she said, could you please read that to me? I read it to her. And she said, is it signed? I said, it is. And she said, okay. She said, thank you. With that in mind, we're not going to take any heroic efforts. We'll do our best with what we can to hopefully get her responsive. She said, I'll call you back in an hour. She called back in an hour and she said, I think you should bring your dad in. I will make sure you can get in here because I don't think she's going to make it. And like, holy moly. So my dad is at that point, just a deer in headlights. I'm still, you know, I'm keeping it together. Trust me, I wasn't here on the verge of tears like at that point. Yeah. And I just said, Dad, we've got to go. And we got into the car. I'll never forget that ride. Yeah, I mean, my dad was just, he was in shock and he was, but he just said some of the most beautiful things my dad ever said to me. Yeah, he just said, you know, if she goes today, just know that she knew that you kept her alive.
Mm.
So, yeah. And so we got there. It was like 8-10 minute ride. And we got in. They put us in hazmat suits because, you know, they didn't know what to do at that point. We were literally in those hazmat suits. They put us in. And we go into the room. My dad's just sitting in a chair off to the side. And I'm sitting there and holding her hand and just rubbing her leg and talking to her. She's not responsive, but because of an experience I had with my sister in 1989, a near-death experience for her, I kept talking to her. 25 minutes later, her eyes open. And the doctor, the nurse who was right outside the door, because he gave us some privacy, like shocked, got the doctor. The doctor came in and said, okay, we have to have you go now. We're going to do whatever we need to do. And she survived. So the what next? JJ, I know that was a long explanation, but it just some context. No.
It was perfect.
The what next? She had to then go through rehab and getting back some strength. 3 months later, my dad was diagnosed with high-grade bladder cancer. And then the journey continued.
Yeah. Woo. Wow.
So that for me is like, for me, because I've that is like a miracle number one, like you saying that you had to read the DNR. I'm not sure how you make it through that. And I know that situation with COVID, I know that happened because they, you know, they can't let you in. And that to me is just an extraordinary event. But I think, you know, you going in and being able to talk to that person, I believe that, you know, touch the sound of your voice. And I believe that changes everything. So I love that. That's like hope to me. That is just like a light. Your dad. So you're 3 months later and you're thinking, okay,
I can breathe maybe a second. Right. In between the doctor's appointments with mom, you're like, Dad, what's going on?
Yeah, when my dad
gets diagnosed.
In, yeah. Oh, yeah,
how did it get found though? I mean, because at this point, because, you know, if you really think about it, is your dad, so let's just back for a teeny second. We know that caregivers nail it when it comes to taking care of our own health.
Exactly
right. And so I think about like my GYN yelled at me because I had been outside of the time frame for my mammogram. And I said, well, I was busy. And Jason even said to me, why didn't you have your mammogram? Because I had an abnormal mammogram a couple of weeks ago, which turned out to be nothing, thank goodness. But it was, well, why didn't you do that? And I'm like, I don't know, because I was in New York doing being your person, and with your cancer treatments. And that's not a guilt thing. That's just like, I didn't even think about me. And so do you think some of that was you guys were focused? Like, so how was your health journey with you and your dad going to doctor's visits and things like that?
Yeah, no, that was fine. That was all fine. All religious appointments, not yeah. religious. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but we get you. We religiously went to our appointments.
Right. No, my dad just came in one day and just said, I think something's wrong. There's blood in my urine. And I was like, okay. So at that point, he was not going to any doctors at Cleveland Clinic. And I said, Dad, if you are okay with it, I'd like us to pursue whatever this may be at Cleveland Clinic. And he said, that's fine. Because he knew what, at that point, with my mom over all those hospitalizations and doctors, he knew that that was the place to go.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So we went and, you know, all the testing and everything showed that he had a high grade. It had moved into the wall of the bladder and he had to have surgery. He had to make a big decision. Mm-hmm. This is a great conversation because when you think about it, he had to make a big decision because the doctors came back after all the testing and everything and asked him, okay, you have two choices. Well, you have three choices. You could do nothing and then you'll be gone within 6 months. Or you have choice number one, which statistically is proven to be the best by a significant margin, which is basically have your bladder removed, have your colon removed, et cetera, and have a bag for the rest of your life.
Okay.
You'll be able to whatever. And the other one was, well, you can go the chemo radiation route. And it's 20, I think it was 20 to 30% less of survival, et cetera, for a period of time. He chose that one. And I never questioned him. It was his choice, his life. And I can't say I would have chose any different because he was thinking, I don't want to live like that with a bag and have to do it. That's a changes life. So yeah, I mean, there's much more to that. But happy to talk about it.
How old was your dad at that time? Just curious.
So my dad at that time was approximately, he just turned 84 the other day. His birthday's 2 days before mine. And my mom's is this coming Monday. I was right in the middle. Their first child, right in the middle. So
very nice. Very convenient for birthday cakes.
Yeah, right. Exactly. That's where my love of birthday cake came from. There we go.
There you go.
Mental note.
Yeah. So this was, it was approximately, I don't even know, time 3-4 years ago. So he was 80, 81.
Yeah. So he knew. He knew how he wanted to live his life. He was like, no, I don't want to.
I don't want to deal with that. I'm ready. The guy, I have to say, going through all of this, his ability to handle going through this treatment has been phenomenal. I mean, he just, number one, he's been fortunate, but I also believe it has to do with frame of mind. And side effects were not that much to the chemo initial. He lost hair, but none of the nausea, none of the vomit, you know, nothing, none of the other things. And the doctor's like, how can this be? And the doctor loaded him up with all these meds.
Mm-hmm.
Never. And then it spread. And then he was given a year to live and on average. And then they went through chemo and radiation again, this time targeted radiation to where it had spread in the up to the lung and the chemo just to get whatever might be in there elsewhere. And never any other than becoming weak, but never any of the others side effects. But he was amazing in handling it. We were always amazed. So
wow. Jay, we need to take a break just for a quick sec for our second break. And gosh, this is good, Todd. Okay, we'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
All right, Natalie, we're back. And Todd was just sharing some really information that I found. I actually wrote it down because I want to remember it.
JG knows how to write, Todd. She was just proving it. Right. Not just drawing.
He said something about his dad's health and about his journey through cancer was that it was about his frame of mind, that made a difference for your dad. It was all about frame of mind that helped him through that journey. So your dad gets to that, he's beating the odds here. I mean, he is in his 80s, but he's like, I'm beating this. And they've told them no. And you get to like this 18 month mark. What's happened at 18 month around that mark? Like, what happens?
18 months from the time it first was diagnosed?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, since it had spread and then he went through that second round of chemo radiation, you know, we're anticipating, okay, where else did it spread at that point? And he goes in for the scans that, you know, they have to wait a month or two for everything to die down from the radiation. And the results come back that there's no detectable sign of cancer. And we're like, I'm reading, because I read every report that comes in before the doctor gets it. And I'm just like, I'm reading it and I can read these. I can understand a lot of it, not all of it for sure, but I can get the gist. And I was like, I called the doctor and he was great. And he called back and said, yeah, I just looked at this. It does not look, you know what? We're going to do a repeat just to make sure that this is correct. And so they might have waited a week or two. I don't even remember. And we went back and dad went in and got it. Same results. And at that point, this is a great topic. Number one, it was a miracle because the doctor said, you realize this is a miracle. He said, I can count on, well, I don't know if I can count on a hand of when this has happened. He said, you had a high grade bladder cancer that metastasized and is gone. He said, you realize this is a miracle. I'm like, yeah, if you're telling us that it's a miracle. So
it's 100% a miracle.
Unbelievable. So what happened then? And this applies to maybe a lot of people listening, hopefully to a lot of people listening who have gone down a road like this, is you're in shock. You are just like, oh my God, you're preparing for the next, what comes next? You know, death at some point. You're preparing for, okay, what am I going to do? My dad at that point was talking about, okay, we're going to be going on a cruise. We're going to be traveling. We're going to be doing whatever. I don't care about COVID. Who cares? We're going to be doing whatever because I got a year to live. But then you're like given this second lease on life. And it, but the interesting part is, and this is really important. Yes, first and foremost, it's about that person who has been given that lease on life. It's also about the caregiver advocate, about their loved ones. It's about the whole family. It's about their world. That all then you have to then adjust and readjust to, whoa, okay, I got goosebumps right now. I mean, it's like, whoa, okay, you got to just adjust what that past 2 years of life was been. And for me, it was really five because of my mom.
Yeah.
And that's another journey. Yeah.
That's so interesting.
That, what, like, what happens? Like, that is what I like, we want to get in. Cause where, first of all, your dad gets the all clear. I mean, are you like, okay, well, what am I supposed to do now? Like, can I get some sleep? I mean, because you're 24/7, 5 years pretty much. I mean, up, down, up, down. I'm thinking maybe there's at least for so many people we talk to, there's been grief involved, even though it's a pre-grief, you're trying to plan for this. What is going on with you?
I'm still in shock. It took me a while. And at that point, this is a huge topic for all caregivers and advocates, let alone the patients, because we're talking about caregiving and advocacy.
That's right. Yeah.
There is what I would say PTSD. And every time there's a test that's done, and I had already been there with my mom. So every time there's a test done with her and then my dad. So every time there's a test or whatever, you're just waiting for what's going to happen. So you're constantly, even though you can, and relax is not the right word, you're still waiting for, okay, what's this test? When I open that up on my chart, what's it going to say, the result? Whether it's blood work for my mom, where's her hemoglobin? Do we have to get her another shot of Aranesp to make sure she's got that, blah, 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 blah. And then even more so with my dad, you know, those first two tests right in a row that showed clear, although we understood it could still microscopically be there. It's then, what do you do next? And it's immunotherapy, which he's been doing now for almost 2 years. So he's almost at the place where he's going to stop immunotherapy because insurance won't cover it after 2 years. And because also immunotherapy can cause other issues. So that third test 3 months later, after those first two, I'm still like, okay, you're not comfortable, because maybe those first two you're thinking were missed. Maybe they were wrong. And this third one, 3 months later, it's going to show up. And it was, again, not. And then you're like, okay. So you're still waiting for that hammer to drop again. You're never totally away from that, having gone through it.
You never do. You never recover. You're always waiting for the shoe to drop.
Yeah, you do. You do. And you're just, it's that PTSD, just waiting for like, okay, whatever. But you start to gain back a semblance of life. And you do, because you have to. You have to find that way, and there are different ways. And my way was writing about my journey with the 1 day, 1 week, which is somewhere above my head.
Yeah.
And that was cathartic, just to share. And then the podcast that I do, which I just like talking to people, and I like, but I wanted other people to share their stories.
Yeah.
And the MyCare friends. And so by doing all these, I started to gain some semblance of life back. And it's been a crazy journey.
Do you think it's clawing back some control in your life? And because caregiving is the least amount of control. And that was the hardest thing for me as a type A. I know that seems shocking to people, that you're like, what? Nellie's a type A? I didn't expect that. But do you think it's trying to claw back some, get some control, and try to say, I don't want anybody else to have to do, to go through this. Like, I hope this helps one person.
That's exactly why I embarked on everything above my head here. It was to help, even if it helped one person or one piece of information helps people, it may not help them immediately in that moment when they hear something. But as we all know, we hear something and then maybe a year, two, five, 10, whatever, like, wow, you draw upon that moment in time, whether it's a piece of information or an experience that we've had, you go, this is when it comes into play. And so, yeah, you're right. That's exactly what this has all been about.
Oh my gosh. You know, Jay, so we could talk to Todd forever, which I know we have. I'm like, in other calls, everybody is like, what do you mean you have? I'm like, yeah, we've been friends for a bit. But it's time for sister questions. And I think sister questions is best. So you start.
Oh my gosh, what will I ask? So I keep going back to what you said about the positive impact for your dad regarding his frame of mind and how that helped with his whole process. Tell me about your frame of mind and how that impacts you going forward. I mean, your life has totally changed, but tell me about your frame of mind and what keeps you sane and what keeps you positive and what keeps you fighting for good. You know, your televangelist, your evangelist sort of lifestyle.
Social good evangelist. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm a positive person. So right. I always want to look at the positive. My mom prior to her getting sick, she'd always say, you always see the positive in a hard situation. I'm like, well, why look at the negative? You know, it's just, if you look at the negative, it's only going to continue negative. All your energy, and we could get into that whole stuff, it's the energy that you put out is the energy you get back. So if you're putting out negative energy, you're attracting negativity. You're attracting energy like that. And if we put out the positive and you're looking at the positive, there'll be negative energy out there, but you're going to attract the positive. And this is not in a woo woo foo foo kind of way. I don't mean it that way. This is, you know what I mean?
I do, but you did live in California. So
I did. So I did. And you know, and some of that was okay at times because it kept me, you know, positive, It's just, let's look at the positive here. Let's look at, rather than if 99% of it is doom and gloom and grim, there's 1% that's positive. And if you focus on that 1%, that can then mushroom and push out that negative and as far as you can. And so that is in part how I went about caregiving and advocacy. It's, you know, there's a lot of crap that you deal with. So, but let's look at, okay, what needs to be done? What can be done? And I think that's really positive as a caregiver and advocate to have that frame of mind, because you help the conversations with that you hopefully are co-creating with the healthcare providers in a positive direction. if they're negative, well, you got to move them in the positive. Let's look at how we can better this situation. What can we do to make this a better situation? I know you're telling me he's got a year to live. Well, what can we do? What is everything we can do to have that go in another direction?
Yeah. Mm. I like that. Well, and that goes into team. And where is your place in the treatment team? And it sounds to me like, and I know a lot of caregivers can probably relate, like I tend to feel like I'm on the outside and no different than your dad was just kind of told, like, you can come back in a couple of days. And your dad was like, okay, because think about, we're told to be respectful of certain positions and the having the courage to say no. And because it took, I mean, it was the same for us. It took, we said no to what the local folks told us and we turned our life upside down and moved into another state. But I can tell you that had we not, Jason's outcome would be so different. My life would be so different right now. Like, and so I wonder about, you know, advice for finding your voice in a room filled with a lot of letters after their name.
Yeah. Now, first off, before I go into that, I don't know if I've ever told you, my middle name is Jason. So,
okay. So that's where the TJ comes from. Okay. Good to know.
Yeah. I had no problem finding my voice.
Me neither.
In part, having worked in and out of healthcare for years, having worked with scientists that are brilliant in pharmaceutical industry, people, CEOs of major corporations, et cetera, et cetera. I've had no problem with my voice. Mm-hmm. It's the way you use your voice. That's the key. Mm. So shortly after my mom got sick, I was officially made the healthcare surrogate. It gave me some easier access to be able to get information and talk with folks. Mm-hmm. You still have to advocate and push in different ways, but it's how you push. It's not, you know, push has a negative connotation, but there's a way to go about it. And so you could call it nudge, you could call it push, you could call it whatever it is, but they're important conversations to have. Yeah. I never had a problem having those conversations with anybody.
Yeah. I think for me, it's definitely taking a deep breath after I see something that makes me want to go off the edge. So, you know, if you had a tip, you had a tip that you would give, what would you give to some caregivers?
Yeah. And I appreciate that follow-up question because now I can better answer JJ's since I didn't fully answer JJ's. Because she did ask, what would I do? How do I handle that? First off, one of the things that's been really important for me since I was going through my divorce in the mid-90s is meditation. Mm. And that can be as simple as, I just need to go step over there for 60 seconds, close my eyes, think of the beach on the island of Kauai that I love, my feet in the sand. Oh, wait, I got to come back. I'm there right now.
You're like, gosh, is that sand?
Is that the island breeze? Oh, I feel great.
No way. Why do I keep having that? And wait, what people can't see is,
that's the wind in my hair. Well, wait, right. God.
No, I'm starting to say, I'm like, what? You know, I need a bottle of like Hawaiian Tropic. They should sponsor this podcast just so I, you know, because I used to get the Hawaiian Tropic, the coconut smell, and I would just sniff it.
Yeah, that's
what they should have. Totally. They should totally have that.
It's like the Banda Soleil I used to use when I was 22 and here in Florida visiting my grandparents. They moved here when they were older. Not that orange stuff that I'd be like slathering on.
This is great.
That smell.
And then you're sniffing yourself a little.
Yeah.
This smells like the beach. Is that grit or is that sand? That's a shower. Oh my God. That's funny. Okay. Last question. And then we're out of time. Okay. And then we'll stick around. What is your favorite guilty pleasure? What is the one thing that you love to do just for you?
Well, I'm going to answer that in two things. My guilty pleasure, as you know, is chocolate.
Oh, he's definitely got chocolate held up, friends. If you're not watching on YouTube,
it wasn't coming through, but
yeah, got it. No, yeah, chocolate love. Thank you, chocolate love. You can sponsor Todd too.
It was a very keen product placement.
All right, I'm like, hi.
Right. That's a really tough question. I love listening to music. So I'm a music person. I have my speakers here. But the thing that's been really helpful is the getting in a car and driving. And turning on music and just opening the windows and the air fresh. That is always, since I first could drive at 16, has been really helpful for me.
Same. Guys, Todd, we love you. We're so excited that you came today. I mean, honestly, this is so wonderful. I'm going to close this out, but stick around. We're going to have some more content. And guys, until we confess again, we'll see you next time. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Well, friends, that's a wrap on this week's confession. Thank you so much for listening in on UK Health Radio. But before you go, please take a moment to leave us a review and tell your friends about the confession show. Don't forget, visit our website to sign up for our newsletter, sign up for the Sisterhood Advantage Club, and of course, connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Pinterest, TikTok, and Twitter. You'll also find the video recording of all our episodes on the Confessions website and our YouTube channel. We'll see you next Tuesday when we come together to confess again. Till then, take care of you.